You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. The extreme right protests we saw this past weekend in Berkeley and Portland were part of a lead up to a much larger event that is planned for Washington, D.C. this Sunday. That day is the 1-year anniversary of extreme right protests in Charlottesville, Virginia. Protests that ended in violent clashes, in gang-style beatings, and in the death of Heather Hare, killed by a white supremacist who drove his car into a crowd of counter-demonstrators. Our next guest has spent the past year tracking down the people who were involved, tracing their ties to the U.S. military in one case and a U.S. military contractor in another, and mapping the growth of the groups that they're part of. A.C. Thompson is an investigative journalist with ProPublica. A Frontline documentary tracking his work premieres tonight at 10 o'clock on PBS stations. It's called Documenting Hate, Charlottesville. AC, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on.
So first off, why did you go to Charlottesville last year?
You know, I had been watching these groups and seeing as they sort of bubbled up in the months previous. And what I could tell from the discussion online and the chatter online was that this would be a large event, that this would be a large rally. And I think what we had seen in the months before that was really worrisome, right? If you go back to Anaheim, California in the spring of 2016, there were three people stabbed at a Klan rally then. You go to Sacramento that summer and there were seven people stabbed at a Nazi event there. You go to the Battles of Berkeley and these other events, and we had sort of seen what seemed like escalating violence at these racist and far-right events. And honestly, I was worried that this might be the biggest and worst of them yet. The folks who were coming there were largely explicit and avowed white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and Klansmen, those type of people. And so I thought, like, there's a certain amount of trolling with these groups, and there's a certain amount of sort of getting the media to help spread their message and their narrative. But in this case, I thought we were looking at a quite serious and dangerous event, and it didn't strike me as sort of a troll job.
So Heather Hare is what most of the press devoted most of its attention to, but the violence was actually quite widespread at this demonstration. There are melees between people who showed up for Unite the Right and counter-protesters, anti-fascist groups. There is a right-wing protester who draws a gun and shoots at counter-protesters. And there's a gang-style beatdown of a black man in a parking garage named DeAndre Harris. You were on the scene, and the first thing that came up in your reporting, as I recall, was that the police seemed very indifferent.
Just want to let you know, it's been all kinds of crazy violence over here. Pepper spray, people beating each other with sticks. We're trying to figure out if the police are going to intervene to stop that or if it's just going to keep going on.
Well, we've all got different assignments to try to maintain some sort of order here. So that's what we're focusing on right now.
You know, even after seeing sort of a lot of bad policing in the months before that, a lot of really sort of lackadaisical policing when it came to these far-right events where people showed up with weapons and then did Game of Thrones-style combat with them, I was stunned. I was frankly stunned at what I saw in Charlottesville. And from the night of August 11th, when the white supremacist marched on the University of Virginia carrying torches, the police allowed widespread and horrific violence to occur over a span of many, 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 many hours. When we looked at our footage from the torch march on the night of the 11th, the video was all of people with the white supremacists beating the counter-protesters in the head with flaming torches. And, you know, basically the police did nothing. They stood by, they allowed this to happen, they were ill-prepared to intervene, and they did not intervene until far too late. And that's what happened throughout the day the next day with a bigger crowd and a more unruly crowd. The official investigation by the city of Charlottesville into what happened found that, you know, on the night of the 11th, the university police at the University of Virginia had failed to intervene, and that had sort of set a tone for people coming to town afterwards. And the tone was, we can get away with violence. We can get away with really extreme acts of aggression, and the police are really not going to do anything. And I think their assessment is correct. By the time Heather Heyer was killed, the whole day was stunning and shocking and so forth and upsetting. But at a certain level, her death wasn't surprising because it sort of felt like this is the sort of natural culmination of political warfare in an American city. It's just going to get worse and worse and worse if there is no meaningful intervention.
Do you have a sense of why the police were so hands-off?
The strong implication from the city's report is that that was an intentional choice, at least on Saturday, August 12th, the day of the big rally, to not intervene until there was significant violence so that it would make it easier to declare a dispersal order and declare that this was an unlawful assembly.
You're saying that the end game for them was a dispersal order and clearing the streets in response to some act of extreme violence, not intervening to say, arrest the person committing the act of extreme violence.
In the city's report, they quote people who had been talking to the chief of police at the time, Al Thomas, and they say that Chief Thomas said, let these people fight. It'll make it easier to declare it an unlawful assembly. Just let them fight. Now, he has denied that, but the finding of the official investigators was that, yeah, that basically this was a conscious decision to allow the violence to continue.
What about the follow-up? Obviously, the young man who mowed down Heather Heyer and other protesters with his car, he was arrested. He's in the process of being prosecuted. What about people responsible for the lesser acts of violence?
You know, by and large, those folks were able to get away with their actions that day without facing any consequences from the authorities. And I mean, sort of one of the things that we wanted to do with our reporting was understand who are the characters who engaged in criminal activity that day? What did they do? Why did they do it? Can we put names to the faces that we see in these videos? And that's what we did. We didn't want to go out and interview the racist leaders. We didn't want to just provide a platform for Richard Spencer or some other racist and let that person spout a bunch of racist junk. We wanted to understand who were the people in the shadows that were carrying out these acts of violence and how were they able to essentially get away with it.
So why don't you walk us through some of the people you identified? Let's start with Robert Rundu.
Yeah, so Robert Rundu is a guy who should be known to folks in Berkeley because he was present at the Tax Day rally in April in 2017 in Berkeley and was briefly arrested there. And Rundu's a guy, he comes from Queens, New York. He used to be involved as a young man with a sort of multi-ethnic, multiracial gang here in New York. And he got into a beef with MS-13, the sort of infamous Salvadoran gang. And in the course of that beef, he ended up stabbing an MS-13 member multiple times, went upstate to New York prison. And when he came out, he started what's basically a white supremacist gang called the Rise Above Movement that's based in Southern California. He moved to California from New York. And he was one of the guys that we looked at as sort of one of the leaders of this basically street fighting white supremacist brigade.
Rise Above Movement, what do they believe in? What do they stand for?
So the Rise Above Movement are sort of like, they're kind of post skinheads, right? They're out of Southern California. They have members spread across the Southland from LA to San Diego. And they are sort of guys who, they've grown their hair out. They don't wear their hair shaved down to the skull. They don't wear bomber jackets and steel-toe boots. They look like jocks. They look like guys that you would see working out at the gym or people that you might see participating in an MMA or boxing match. And really what they're trying to do is sort of update the skinhead look and subculture for a new generation. They view themselves as sort of defenders of the white race And they mean that quite literally.
So this particular guy, Robert Rundu's trajectory is interesting because you're describing him as part of a multi-ethnic gang when he's in Queens, and then his transformational moment appears to be the time he does in prison.
Right. And, you know, from everything we can tell, he had started going in the racist direction before he went to prison, but it seems like that time sort of cemented it for him.
So I guess, like, the question that comes to my mind is, you're describing groups like the Rise Above movement basically as a rebranding of the type of white supremacist groups that existed kind of on the fringes of the punk scene in the 1990s.
Right.
Are there appreciable differences in their ideology or their structure, or is it just the haircuts and what they're wearing?
It's interesting because for a group like Rise Above, they're not really using Nazi iconography. With the Nazi skinheads, they wanted to be offensive. They wanted to be in your face. They wanted to fly the swastika and these sort of all the different imagery and iconography of the Third Reich and really offend and upset people. With the Rise Above movement, what they're doing is they're taking their cues from the far right movements in Europe, which basically say, hey, we're nationalists. We just want a good, strong, healthy country. And by the way, we're kind of white nationalists, and we kind of like it if nobody ever immigrated to this country again, particularly not brown folks. But when you first check these guys out, you are not going to think they are a bunch of fascists or they are a bunch of Nazi sympathizers or Nazis. You're going to think these are a bunch of jocks. So I think the ideology is quite similar to the sort of explicit Nazi ideology, but the sort of packaging, the rebranding, the branding of it is quite different. The guys in Rise Above movement, from what I can tell, are really inspired by Julius Evola, who was an Italian fascist and an active member of the Third Reich during the Nazi times in Nazi Germany. So that is their sort of intellectual inspiration, is a full-on Nazi and fascist.
So one of the goals of that original Unite the Right demonstration in Charlottesville, as I understand it, was to help inject what they call white nationalist views and politics into the conservative mainstream. And that in some of the internal chat windows that we've had a peek into, thanks to leaks, the organizers of Unite the Right in Charlottesville saw the killing of Heather Hare and the publicity that resulted as a major setback on that end. How did people like the organizations that you started investigating see that event?
So it kind of goes in three different ways. There were people who felt like our movement is ruined now, and there were people who said, you know, I feel like I'm going to step away from this kind of politics. The consequences are too high. People are starting to look at me like I'm a terrorist, and I don't want to do this. There were other groups like Identity Europa and Patriot Front that came out of that, and they said, hey, we're not going to tell people when we're going to hold rallies. We're not going to announce our presence in advance. We're going to operate in a sort of more guerrilla fashion. So we'll do banner drops, we'll do postering, we'll do sort of on-the-fly flash mob rallies, but we're not going to let people know for months in advance where we are and show up and get into altercations. And then the third group said, you know what? The lesson of Charlottesville is that politics don't work, that protesting in the street doesn't work, that we will always be pariahs. And what we should do is engage in terrorism to overthrow the U.S. government. And this is a sign that now is the time for us to go underground and start and take up arms against the government.
So the most extreme group that you wound up digging into in that vein is something called Adam Waffen Division. Who are they?
The strongest membership is in Texas. And these guys are sort of, they're sort of the opposite in a lot of ways of the Rise Above movement. Adam Waffen is like, we are Nazis. Don't get it twisted. We are absolutely Nazis. And if you don't call us Nazis, we'll be offended. And the thing is, they actually really mean it. They're not just trolling. I have read many, many, many of their internal chats, and I've talked to people in the group, and they absolutely mean that. sort of touchstones are the book The Turner Diaries, which inspired Tim McVeigh to blow up the Oklahoma City bombing, and it's about a sort of plan to ignite a race war in America. And their other sort of touchstone is a book called Siege that was authored by a longtime member of the American neo-Nazi movement who said, hey, we're done with politics. This is the time of lone wolf attacks. This is the time of guerrilla struggle. This is the time of assassinating people of color and politicians we don't like.
So that's the writing. What do they actually do?
Well, so far the group has been tied to five homicides and a bomb plot. So the founder of the group was arrested for possession of actually the same bomb material that Tim McVeigh used, another high explosive, detonators and fuses, radiological material, and a bunch of other scary stuff. And one of his members of his group said that he had been planning to blow up the Miami nuclear power plant. He's now serving 5 years in federal prison on those explosive charges.
So they're public about their politics, but not public about their identities. This is a group that follows some information security protocols. They use encrypted chats. How did you start, identifying their members, the people who'd been committing acts of violence at demonstrations?
For us to figure out who these people were was a big challenge, but using the logs that we had access to, that helped. Using internal documents that we had from within the group, that helped. Using information from insiders helped us. So we had a bunch of ways to develop that information.
The people who are leaking you documents and chat logs from inside the group, why are they doing it? What motivates them?
I have my ideas, but I can't really say anything about that.
I want to close out the interview talking about one person in particular you identified through repeated photos and footage of him violently beating people at demonstrations. The name you eventually came up with was Vasilius Pistolis. Tell us about him.
Vasilius Pistolis was, at the time when we were doing our reporting, an active duty Lance Corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was stationed at Camp Lejeune down in North Carolina. And he, from everything we can tell, attended Unite the Right, engaged in multiple assaults. There are photos and videos of him bludgeoning people with a big wooden dowel that he had used as a flagpole. We believe that he attacked other people as well, including Emily Gorsensky, a Charlottesville activist. And he spent a lot of time online in confidential chats bragging about his exploits at Unite the Right. One of his messages said something like, I split three skulls today with virtually no damage to myself.
The most troubling thing here is the fact that he's an active duty member of the Marine Corps. Do we have a sense of why he signed up for the Marines? Whether it was, that he's just a white supremacist in the Adam Waffen who happens to be in the Marines, or that, he got some direction to join up?
I do not know. And that's a great question. But what we do know is that his social media history suggests that he was sympathetic or involved in the Nazi movement before he enlisted in the Marine Corps. What his own statements have said is that he was involved with organized white supremacists going back to the age of 16. So I don't think that this was a new phenomenon for him after he got into the service. I absolutely believe he was involved with the movement before he joined. What I don't know is why he joined, or if somebody put him up to it and essentially said, hey, this is good training you can get for the movement. Get in there and learn how to wage war.
The U.S. military's official policy is to frown on neo-Nazis joining the military. What did they do when they found out?
Well, here's the disturbing thing. We published our story about Vasilius Pistolis, and then a former Marine named Ed Beck contacted us and said, hey, great story about Pistolis. By the way, I contacted the Marine Corps about 6 months ago and talked to military investigators and said, hey, this guy is an active duty Nazi. He's been involved in altercations in Charlottesville and participated in another Nazi rally in Tennessee, you need to do something about this. And it does not seem like the Marine Corps launched a robust effort to figure out what the deal was with Pistolas. We know there was an investigation, but we also know that 6 months later, when we did our story, he was still in the Marine Corps. And it wasn't until after we published our story that they actually court-martialed him, sentenced him to time in military jail, and then ousted him from the service.
You managed to get through to him on the phone, and that was an interesting conversation.
Yeah. What he told me is, he said, you know, I'm not involved with any organized white supremacist groups anymore, but...
But I'm not saying I'm not, I don't have certain beliefs, but I'm not trying to be involved with anything stupid, is what I'm getting at.
And he had sort of different explanations about, was he in Charlottesville, was he not in Charlottesville, did he really assault people, or was he just joking online? And I said, hey, you know...
There's video, man, of you there. You know, there's video of you launching yourself into that crowd. It doesn't seem like a joke. It doesn't seem like posting. It seems like something else entirely.
How about this? Let me leave you on this note. None of this comes out. And a few years from now, I will help you with your career.
So that's very brazen. Do you think it was sincere?
Do I think he sincerely wanted to say things about people he didn't like in the movement and expose them? Yeah, probably. Probably.
AC Thompson, looking ahead, there are these demonstrations planned for Washington, D.C. Sunday as a one-year anniversary of Unite the Right in Charlottesville. Any sense of what's different? Is it a different constellations of organizations working in the planning? Are they bigger or smaller now than they were a year ago?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a big event. I think it's going to be a bust. And part of that is because, like I said, the movement has steered itself in different directions. And I don't think that most people involved with that movement believe that big public protests is the way to go. But also, most of the people involved with the movement have been alienated from the organizer of Charlottesville and the organizer of this event, Jason Kessler, and they don't trust or like him. So I just don't see him having the charisma and respect to mobilize a lot of people again.
All right. AC Thompson, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Hey, thank you.
AC Thompson is an investigative journalist with ProPublica. He's been tracking the people and organizations behind last year's deadly alt-right demonstrations in Charlottesville. A Frontline documentary tracking his work premieres tonight at 10 o'clock on PBS stations. It is called Documenting Hate, Charlottesville.